Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This appeal brings to this Court a basic question of equity jurisdiction. Plaintiffs brought this case as a tort and contract action seeking recovery of the purchase price of a business. The relationship was contractual. There was no claim of a fiduciary or other equitable relationship. The plaintiffs sought damages. They didn't seek recovery of a specific fund. They didn't seek the return of assets. They abandoned any claim for rescission. And they did not claim equitable ownership of the sold assets. They added to their complaint a claim for a constructive trust over the assets, essentially as a means to recover their damages. Now, the plaintiffs, on a motion to dismiss on the ground of lack of subject matter jurisdiction, did not allege or offer any evidence that the defendants were not able to respond to a damages judgment, no matter how one measured those damages. And there was no showing that execution process, if necessary to enforce the award, would be unavailing.
What was the record that was developed?
I do not believe that any party submitted any evidence.
So this is all on the complaint?
It was on the complaint. Of course, the plaintiff had the opportunity to submit evidence, but rested on the complaint.
Well, isn't it inferable from the complaint that a situation could arise where a constructive trust would be required in order to preserve the plaintiff's right to collect damages? I mean, if there had been shift of funds from the defendant to other parties, you've got a judgment collection problem, and equitable remedies could be used to address that.
Well, that would certainly be a theory, Your Honor. The problem with that is then many normal contract claims can come to the Court of Chancery claiming that there's a possibility that money has been reallocated outside, and therefore I'm asking for constructive trust, and therefore I have the right to be in Chancery. I think the proposition goes opens up the door.
Are you saying that the proper way to proceed would be to get a money judgment in Superior Court, and if you can't collect it, then go to Chancery?
I think if there is some showing that there was the equivalent of a fraudulent conveyance. No, in the first instance, Your Honor, if money has been passed on to the third person, a constructive trust would not assist in that because the money is gone to a party not before the court.
Because you'd have to have a whole merits proceeding on the entitlement to an equitable remedy, even though the plaintiff in the Chancery case would already have been awarded a money judgment at law. Correct?
You would have to, yes, at some point, either in some form, it would lead to a situation where you'd have to have a showing that there was no money to be got, and therefore the assets and seizure through law of the assets was insufficient. But that it circles back on each other. What's the point of constructive trust if you have the ability to issue execution warrants, fieri facias or whatever they're called, to seize the assets and sell them through that method? Therefore, a constructive trust is usually used for assets which the person does not have the lawful right to have in its possession. It is not used as a method of collection. And that is why it is inappropriate in this case, because there is an adequate remedy at law on the execution side. There's issue writs to have the sheriff seize the assets, sell the assets. And if you can do that, then what is the purpose of a constructive trust? And this is not a constructive case, trust case, because they are not claiming that the defendants have no right to possession of the assets. They're saying they had the right pursuant to a contractual agreement. We just want the money
Well, there was a claim, and also there was a claim for reformation that was made.
There was a claim in the original complaint, Your Honor, That was the original complaint was dismissed. They amended the complaint, and they did not reassert the reformation claim. They abandoned it.
And what about unjust enrichment?
Unjust enrichment, Your Honor, this court has said two things. It said that where unjust enrichment is being offered as a as an alternative to a contract claim, it is a legal claim. And this court has also stated, and we cite the cases in our brief, that to have unjust enrichment in the court of chancery, there must be no adequate remedy at law. Because the Superior Court does hear unjust enrichment claims as alternative to contract claims when the only remedy sought is damages. And that is at the core of this case. This is at core a contract, a claim to enforce a damages claim under a contract. And our courts, at least the Court of Chancery, has consistently recognized that a request for a constructive trust will not confer subject matter jurisdiction on the Court of Chancery where damages are a full, fair, and complete remedy. And there was no suggestion in the Court of Chancery that damages would not make them whole and could not be obtained. Therefore, absent any of these traditional touchstones, there's no showing for a basis for equitable jurisdiction beyond speculation. And, Your Honor, that is the core and the sum and the substance of the point on equity jurisdiction. And unless Your Honor has any honors have any other questions on that, I'm prepared to move to the statute of limitations argument. Thank you, Your Honor. Again, I'll be succinct here as well. The claims, again, were all legal in nature, and the remedy of damages is essentially what they want, and that's the legal remedy. Therefore, it's the statute of limitations that applies in this case and not latches. However, the court really doesn't need to address that specifically because even by analogy in such a case, the statute of limitations would be looked at and the three-year period would be deemed to be the presumptive period after which it is presumptively prejudicial. The cause of actions accrued, strike that, the injury accrued when, at closing, when the plaintiffs did not receive their money as set forth in the contract.
But you agree that the statute of limitations serves as a guide, but latches can be employed to bar a claim for a shorter period, and latches can be denied after a longer period, right?
I agree, Your Honor. If this were a latches case, that analysis would be correct. There are circumstances where latches can foreclose a case even if it's shorter than the statute of limitations. There are also circumstances where latches can extend the statute of limitations if the three-year period is not followed. However, in all cases in Chancery where the statute of limitations is applied by analogy, the three-year period, once it crosses that threshold, is deemed time after that is deemed to be presumptively prejudicial to the defendant, and there has to be some showing ameliorating that prejudice. And this is a classic case where a three-year period was prejudicial. If the court reviews the transcript of the trial, there was a lot of failed memory. This is not a clear record by any stretch. At one point, I started counting the number of times where someone said, "I don't remember." And because this was after 3 years, a lot of water under the bridge, particularly Mr. Marconi, the attorney, had many other cases, many other transactions, and he was not able to recall with great specificity what happened.
So where specifically did the Vice Chancellor get it wrong?
The Vice Chancellor got it wrong by suggesting that it was inherently unknowable. And as we cited the D.C. case, we said, failure to get money when due is not inherently unknowable. It's a latent injury, or a patent injury, not a latent injury. He also got it wrong when he said that the plaintiffs didn't realize that they weren't going to get paid because there was some discussion amongst the parties about that, issues that had to be resolved before payment. And the Court of Chancery in subsequent cases has said settlement negotiations cannot toll the statute of limitations because it would create an incentive for plaintiffs to negotiate in bad faith for the purpose of extending the statute of limitations. And in one case, then Vice Chancellor Strine, now Chancellor Strine, made the point that if the negotiations end before the statute of limitations had expired, one cannot tack on that period to extend the statute of limitations. So the Court of Chancery erred in finding that the statute of limitations was extended under the doctrine of inherently unknowable injury. It also erred in finding that the six-year statute of limitations for promissory notes applied here, because certainly the individuals were not signatories to a promissory note, and he said there was an implied promissory note. However, the statute of limitations refers to 3 years for promises not evidenced by a record. That's the express language of the statute. And therefore, I respectfully submit that there cannot be such a thing as an implied promissory note. A promissory note is, by definition, a document evidenced by a record. And we've cited some cases in our brief which lends support to that suggestion. So the fact that it was looked at as latches instead of the statute of limitations, and these tolling provisions were where the court erred, we respectfully submit. One other point, the Court of Chancery suggested that there was a fraudulent misrepresentation which misled the plaintiffs and kept them from investigating their rights. They claim that fraudulent misrepresentations was Mr. Marconi's notarization, saying, I find that these corporations exist, this corporation exists. However, as the cases we have cited, and they're not Delaware cases clearly, but we present them for their persuasive value, state that the type of fraudulent misrepresentation required to toll the statute of limitations cannot be the same misrepresentation that is the basis for their fraud claim. There must be a subsequent misrepresentation to cover up the earlier wrong. And the plaintiffs in this case conflated the two. So those are the statute of limitations points. And the defendants never said anything to the plaintiffs to mislead them into believing that payment was forthcoming. There's nothing in the record to support that suggestion. And the defendants or the plaintiffs knew at all times that they had not been paid and chose, for their own reasons, to focus their attentions elsewhere and to
well,
wait.
When you say that they knew that they hadn't been paid, wasn't there some period of time where supposedly the money had been put in escrow because there was some question about other documentation or the existence of another corporation, whatever, but that the appearances were that the $10,000 was safely tucked away somewhere, not that they were refusing to pay.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. The $10,000 of the $290,000 or $300,000 was put there. That was the initial payment that was supposed to be made. And there was some negotiation about that. But the negotiations finished approximately a month in with no resolution, and nothing happened thereafter. So the plaintiffs were content to just let it sit there indefinitely. And at some point, I think it's incumbent upon them to take some action. And otherwise, they could use that, supposing they had waited 10 years, would the same fact that it was sitting there all this time be sufficient to extend the statute of limitations for 10 years? At some point, it becomes...
Well, that's not what we've got here. What have we got, 5 months or something?
Well, we've got three-plus years, Your Honor, from the time of the escrow. The escrow existed until after the litigation had begun. And there was nothing beyond the first month's negotiation. The testimony of Mr. Walters was that he kept trying to contact Mr. Coleus. Mr. Coleus would not respond. But for these reasons, Your Honor, the statute of limitations should be deemed to bar this action. We've raised a third point in our briefs about de facto corporations and personal liability versus corporate liability, but unless the Court has any questions, I'm content to leave that in my argument to the briefing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Henry Hyman, Cooch & Taylor for Envo, Inc. At counsel table with me is Susan Kaufman, another lawyer in the firm. I disagree to some extent with my friend as to what this case is or is not about. The court has written two memorandum opinions, one in 2009, one in 2012, which deals at length with each of the issues raised by the defendants. First, I think I would state, and I know the court is well aware of this, that factual findings must be accepted if the findings are sufficiently supported by the record and are the product of an orderly and logical deductive process.
Was there a factual record?
Yes, sir. The factual record came in two parts. There was a very large number of documentary exhibits that came into the case, and there was a day and a half of testimony from four witnesses, as I recall. Additionally, the court had had the parties before him several times before the trial on various motions of different types, motions to dismiss twice, motion for summary judgment. So the judge was very well aware at the time that he took the bench at the time of the trial as to what he would be looking for in order to find a factual record to support whatever conclusion that the court intended to come to. I also suggest to the court that Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision should be only overturned if it is clearly wrong. Absent that, the balance goes to where the case was at the time that it left the Vice Chancellor. Unless there's abuse of discretion, it's arbitrary or capricious, there is really no issues that the court need look at beyond that. However, let me discuss some of the issues because the court may have some issues or problems with it. The first is the issue of equitable or subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction vests in the Court of Chancery if there is no full, fair, and practical or complete relief available from some other source, be it another court, administrative hearing, somewhere else.
Well, subject matter jurisdiction was, I mean, ultimately grounded on the claim for constructive trust relief, which is clearly equitable.
Yes, sir.
The claim here is that that was error as a matter of law because damages would have been, a damage award would have been an adequate remedy, and there's nothing, no fact of record or evidence of record that would show otherwise. How do you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the issue of subject matter jurisdiction is decided at the time of the pleadings, that is, when the documents or when the issue is joined. The fact that it may later turn out to be that the equitable portion or even the equitable remedy that the court decided that it was looking to for jurisdiction is abandoned, the court may still and should still continue to resolve the case because the Court of Chancery has taken the jurisdiction. Once it has it, the court has it. There's the cases of Trustiancia Management Group as well as Triton Construction.
Well, what does this mean? Can somebody file a complaint that initially asserts claims for equitable relief and then amend the complaint and drop it to a legal claim and still go forward in Chancery? Is that your position?
No, sir. I don't believe that's an accurate statement of what the court said. The court spent a great deal of time dealing with the facts as he had them, as had been presented to him in the pleadings. And he looked at the various counts, and he said, you have to look at these counts, you have to look at what the plaintiff is actually seeking before you make a determination as to whether or not you want to assume subject matter jurisdiction in the Court of Chancery. And Vice Chancellor Parsons did that. In that decision, he threw out the reformation claim and found that four and six, both of which sought constructive trust, were a basis for his believing that subject matter jurisdiction was a correct way to go.
We understand that, but the argument that's made in response is that the possible need for constructive trust at the complaint stage was so far-fetched, so remote, that the court should not have taken it seriously or given it credit, and therefore all that was left was essentially a damages claim which required a dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes, sir. With all due respect, looking at the record as a whole and looking at the transaction as a whole, the court will see that there was no party on the purchasing side of the entity. In fact, the contract merely provided for Envo to sell or assets to something that never existed, ever. A money judgment against a non-existent entity is, by definition, not a full, fair, and complete relief. I mean, I don't see how one could argue that that would give you what you needed. In order to get to the assets, you had to go through this non-existent company.
To whoever, whichever defendant held them, right?
Well, to go to the assets, yes. The argument that somehow Mr. Marconi was the improper person who created the problem is really not relevant. He was their agent. They were the principal. Whatever Mr. Marconi did is their responsibility. The court found...
Well, let me just make sure. I gather what you're saying is that the other side is wrong, that the need for a constructive trust, as alleged in the complaint, was not far-fetched. It wasn't remote.
No, sir.
Because?
Because the only way to get to the assets would be through an equitable remedy of constructive trust.
All right.
Also, the arguments of unjust enrichment.
The complaint alleged that there was no party on the purchasing side?
That's correct.
And that as a result, in order to recover anything, one would have to use a constructive trust to follow the assets?
That was one of the theories, yes, Your Honor. Certainly, the imposition of personal liability was something that was also sought. Whether you consider it piercing the corporate veil or some other argument, that's still a chancery court.
Right, that occurred remedy. To me as well, but there's no mention in the opinion about piercing the corporate veil.
Well, because there's nothing there. There's no there.
There's no corporation to pierce.
The corporation, the assets of the seller went to the use of Mr. Walters. The corporation that Mr. Walters created a month after the settlement never obtained those assets. There was never an assignment, a merger, any kind of agreement. They didn't try to retroactively assume the contract, nothing. So what we have is nothing.
The argument is, as I understand it, that, okay, we, you know, that whatever happened here was either the result of a fraud.
Yes, sir.
An outright fraud or an equitable fraud or at worst or best a negligent misrepresentation made by the individual defendants, the only remedy you need is a money judgment against them. They were the perpetrators. They're the ones who should be financially responsible. So why wouldn't the money judgment against both of them or one of them jointly and severally be sufficient?
If for the same reason that the defendants are here and have argued that there is no right to personal liability against them. So if we were in seeking a money judgment solely in the court, Superior Court, and we failed in that regard, that would have been a loss. There is nothing that says you can't go into equity and with the equity jurisdiction, also ask for legal remedies. That's what happened here. And the court, as equitable courts do, configured a remedy to justify the circumstances that the judge found.
Well, you can go into equity and ask for a legal remedy if the claim is an equitable claim.
Yes, sir.
Is that what you claim you did here?
Absolutely.
And what was the equitable claim?
Constructive trust.
No, that's a remedy. That's not a claim.
Promissory estoppel in count six, and count three was, I believe, equitable fraud.
All right. Was that your theory of jurisdiction then, or was it a two-pronged? That is, we're seeking an equitable remedy, but even if we don't get the equitable remedy, we have alleged equitable claims on the basis of which a legal remedy could be granted.
That's correct,
Your Honor. Either way, there would be subject matter jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
All right.
The same issue, in a sense, goes to the statute of limitations, which was raised as to what is the appropriate statute of limitations. Vice Chancellor Parsons spent a great deal of time in his 2009 memorandum decision in dealing with the situation on laches. And when it was raised yet again,
and before you, I'd like to back up.
Yes, sir.
The equitable jurisdiction is based on promissory estoppel and equitable fraud.
Yes, sir.
Could those very claims have been brought in the Superior Court? And if not, why not?
I guess you could bring anything you wanted in Superior Court. The question is whether you would get a full, fair, and complete relief as the result of the decision that you would get in Superior Court. And I think the answer to that is no, because the primary target defendant in this situation would be a non-existent entity. You can't bring an action, in my opinion, against the attorney for anything he may or may not have done, because he's simply the agent of the principals. And they're tarred with what he did and what he didn't do, and what they created was a construct that they never bothered to tell anybody outside of those three about. Now, whether that was negligence because it just never happened, Mr. Marconi, we know, left the scene even before any of this happened because he had not been paid. The court asked about the $10,000 that at one point was then put into an interpleader action in the Court of Common Pleas.
So you're saying, in answer to Justice Richley's question, yes, perhaps the equitable estoppel claim, promissory estoppel claim, equitable fraud claims could have been brought in Superior Court, but that doesn't change or at least solve the problem that even if you get a money judgment against the individuals, they could very well have transferred these assets somewhere else, and you would need constructive trust relief.
You might need,
and that it would that you're not required to file two separate suits in order, you know, to get there. That is, you can combine all of those claims in one suit, and that would have to be in Chancery.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was what I hoped that was done here.
All right.
If we needed to go through some of the other issues, constructive trust is a way to impose certain restrictions on assets. Money judgments don't do that. I'm sure Mr. Finger is well aware that you can't touch.
Right. Well, if the individuals, if you have a money judgment against the individual defendants and they either judgment proof and or you can't reach them for or execute for some reason, you can still go against the assets which constituted the business that was sold.
Yes, Vice Chancellor Parsons found that in addition to the two individual defendants, there was also liability with the new corporation, or what we were calling New Environmental.
Right. Moving back to the laches, I don't understand why the parties are spending so much time debating which statute applied when it's clear that this is a laches case, and no matter which statute applied, there has to be a showing that the late filing, if there was a late filing,
yes, sir,
was prejudicial. And here, nobody's really made out an argument that filing the complaint even 1 month after the shorter statute prejudice the defendants at all. So why the debate about 3 years or 6 years or 5 years?
I think that that same question occurred to Vice Chancellor Parsons in his decision. He just said it's 6 years. He decided it was 6 years.
Right.
In Obiter, he said, even if it were a three-year statute of limitations, he didn't say it was. He says, even if, then we would have to look at other issues, which would include equitable tolling, who knew what, when. Those are the decisions that he made in his opinion and found that, in fact, equitable tolling was appropriate, and therefore, even under a three-year statute of limitations, it would have been timely. I agree with Your Honor that there is really no need to get into that because I don't think it is a fruitful discussion.
And I think the third argument is that, you know, the
facto
judgment was eventually entered was erroneous because the parties contemplated that there would be only corporate liability. And I gather the response is, if there was a corporation that actually existed and received the assets that were sold, that might be a viable argument, but it isn't viable when there is no corporation, which is
the
factual foundation of the claim.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I appreciate your statement. I go also to the point that what was created by their agent. The problems of the non-existent corporation was created by their agent. They have to live with that. The court also found that when they knew about these things, they never bothered to tell Mr. Coleus. They simply just let it drift. He was paid a certain amount per month against his accounts receivable advanced costs, and he figured that was what he was going to get in that time frame. Then eventually that stopped, of course. He had an expectation, and a legitimate expectation, as the court found, that the notes, that the promises that were made, were in fact legitimate promises, that they would be able to be...
I'm not sure what all of that adds to your
position. It's a question of who has responsibility for these notes signed by an entity that doesn't exist. That's where this goes. I think that if Mr. Coleus had been aware that there was no such entity, actions would have been taken. He could have gone to rescission. There were other things, even as the court suggests, that might have happened. On the other hand, none of that happened. They simply sat there. And they effectively induced him to wait by their conduct. And as a result of that...
You're arguing that they should be equitably estopped from arguing this, apart from the legalistic argument that there was no corporation.
Yes, sir. Well, and Vice Chancellor Parsons said the same thing. But he also said at the end in one of the footnotes, I don't have to get into other theories because the theory that I have developed and espoused in my opinions, the findings that I have made based upon the evidence that he saw, were sufficient in order to ground the decision that was made. If there are any other questions, I have another minute, and I don't know if there's a questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may, Your Honor, first I'd like to respond to Justice Ridgely's question about equitable estoppel and fraud, whether they asserted in the Superior Court. As noted in our reply brief, or rather promissory estoppel, I apologize, is a claim that can be brought in either court. However, for it to be brought in Chancery, there has to be no adequate remedy at law. Similarly, equitable fraud can legal fraud can be brought in Superior Court. Equitable fraud can only be brought in Chancery, but again, it requires either a fiduciary relationship or an adequate remedy at law. So all this argument goes back to the point, was there an adequate remedy at law? And it goes back to the point, what is the purpose of a constructive trust? I've not found any Delaware court that said the purpose of a constructive trust is to assist in the collection of damages. And they wanted their contract damages. What constructive trust is used for is to recover assets or a specific fund of money when it is claimed that the possessor, the holder of those assets or money, does not have a right to them. And there's no claim.
Well, the possessor of the assets turned out to be the new corporation, which was not, did not exist at the time that the transact, the sale transaction took place.
That's correct,
Your Honor. And it wasn't contemplated by the sales agreement. It was essentially a stranger to this entire transaction, leading to the defense that there's no claim, at least no claim at law, either in tort or contract, against the new corporation. It would have to be a claim in equity to the effect that that corporation is improperly holding the property belonging to the plaintiff and has to hold it in trust for the plaintiff, who's legitimately entitled to legal title.
Respectfully, Your Honor, there was a legal claim that could be brought, and there was a legal basis for liability found. It was found to be promissory estoppel, alternatively an implied contract.
But the new corporation did not engage in any conduct that would have subjected it to that kind of claim. It came into existence after.
That's true. However, as the Vice Chancellor found, it received the assets and it utilized the assets. And therefore, there was, unjust enrichment could be a legal basis to claim it used the assets, it benefited from the assets, and therefore it had a duty to pay for the assets. So I respectfully submit it's not a foregone conclusion that there was no legal claim that could have been brought against the new entity. And there was an option the plaintiffs had to file a reformation claim against the new entity, to say the contract. The evidence in the record shows that all the parties were aware that the name ESG was not going to be the ultimate entity. And that is why the Envo name, or the Environmental Solutions name, was sold. And that is why Envo gave up the name and changed the name of its entity. It knew there was going to be an entity. It may not have known that there was going to be a new corporation, but it knew there was going to be an entity, Environmental Solutions Group, that was going to be responsible for the contract. So I can very well foresee legal claims. There was not a claim for unjust enrichment. There's no claim that they had no right to these assets. They wanted my clients to have the assets, but pay for them. They forswore rescission. They forswore any attempt at recovery. And again, as I was saying, I found no Delaware case which suggests that the purpose of a constructive trust is to take the place of execution process under law so as to confer jurisdiction on the Court of Chancery. And this is a small point, but just so I'm not waiving it, I disagree respectfully with Mr. Hyman that...
Well, help me with this aspect of it. If the corporation is newly formed, what is the basis to get a judgment in the Superior Court against an entity that didn't exist at the time of the...
It may not have existed at the time of the wrong, but it had an independent wrong by taking the assets and using it for its own financial benefit. That's an unjust enrichment claim.
Under what theory?
Unjust enrichment at law.
Yeah, but even if there is an unjust enrichment claim, that doesn't necessarily get the plaintiff the relief.
Well, they have to prove it. But that gets them a relief.
It may get them a money judgment against the new corporation.
Yes, and that makes that is the legal remedy.
Yeah, but it's not your argument is that to a certitude, the judge should have found that that remedy would have been adequate, and maybe it wasn't so certain.
We don't know because there was. The question is, what is required at the pleading stage? Older cases say there should be an allegation that the party is unable to respond in damages. Whether they can prove that later is another thing. But this issue was raised below. At below, we argued that they never said anything about inability, and the plaintiffs never took up the opportunity to seek discovery on that limited point or to argue to the contrary. And again, in closing, there, if certitude is required, a lot more cases are going to be brought in chancery that are simple contract cases, because one really never knows without discovery who can pay and who can't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the argument. We'll take the matter under advisement and have a recess.